He studied in Paris and did a bachelor in cellular biology, then a master in neuroscience, and then he went to UCSD in San Diego and worked with Terry Sinofsky, did a PhD in biology. He then went to Los Angeles and worked with John Schlag, and in 1996 he became an assistant professor in Georgetown, and then 1999 he moved to Rochester, became associate professor there in 2002, and in, well, actually just a year ago he moved to Switzerland, to Geneva, where he is in the lab of cognitive computational neuroscience. His interest is in aspects of uncertainty in neuronal computation, and his talk today will be on probabilistic approaches to coding and computation.
Okay, is this working? Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I've got to apologize to the organizers because I did one of the things that I really hate when I organize conferences is one of those speakers who decided to change their talk right before the conference. And it's particularly embarrassing because I'm sure I was paired with Greg DeAngelis for a reason, because we collaborate, and I was supposed to talk about the theory behind some of the stuff that Greg will present. But instead, I decided to talk about something else, which we're kind of excited about, and hopefully that you will enjoy too. So it's called Noi Knows It Just Wrong, and this is work that was done with those guys here, Wei Jima, Jeff Beck, Peter Latham, Zach Pico, and Ingmar Kennicheider, all like current or former postdocs of the lab or long-term collaborators like Peter Latham. Okay, so as you all know, there is variability in our behavior. It's basically impossible to reproduce the same movement from one trial to the next. And this is well illustrated by this particular slide here, which I got from Philippe Sabus, who got his hand on a set of videos of one of the best baseball pitcher in the game right now, throwing fastball one after the other during a particular game. And what he measured here was the variability in the position of the hand at the time of the release of the ball from trial to trial. And what you should know is that at baseball, when you throw a fastball, if you throw it well, you're trained to throw it in exactly the same way from attempt to attempt. You have to show as little variability as possible. And this guy was one of the best. And nonetheless, there is a little bit of variability in his behavior. Okay, it's indicated by the red dot here. There's about 1 inch of variability in all directions. And so I like this slide because it makes really two important points. One, it confirms one of my suspicions about baseball. When I saw my first game of baseball in the US, I was just appalled. Because it looked like the worst game in sports you could imagine. They do exactly the same thing from pitch to pitch. Well, this is scientific evidence that I'm correct. Okay? They call it sometimes the game of inches. In fact, it's a game of 1 inch, it turns out. So that's baseball for you right there. But it showed that nonetheless, there is variability in the behavior, even if you paid millions of dollars, which is the case of this guy, for doing exactly the same thing. So it doesn't matter how motivated you are, there is variability. And you might say, well, why should I bother about variability, right? If I give you a computer, I'm trying to understand how it works, I measure electronic components and I see noise, it would be ridiculous to think, well, where is the noise coming from, and spend your life studying the noise in the computer. Instead, you want to understand how it computes. But in the case of the brain, I think it's a key problem, because in order to understand what it is in neural responses that produces behavior variability, you need to understand the mapping from neural activity onto behavior. And that's, of course, one of the big questions that we want to answer as computational neuroscientists. So who is to blame? Well, if you review the literature, I think it's fair to say that many people have been blaming the near Poisson variability in spike trains. And when I say many people, I include myself in that group. So it's been known for years that if you show, for instance, a stimulus like this in the receptive field of empty neurons, and you record their responses, and here every dot is a spike, every line is a trial, this is data from the Newson group, the timing of the spikes and the number of the spikes varies greatly from trial to trial. And it seems to follow more or less what you expect from a Poisson process. Not exactly, but close enough. And so on the one hand, we have Poisson variability. On the other hand, we have behavioral variability. So it's tempting to think that, indeed, the behavioral variability is caused by the Poisson variability. And again, I have several papers myself where we make this argument, but I would say like the vast majority of the papers that I know follow this particular logic. So I'm going to argue that, in fact, there is another cause of variability that perhaps we have ignored, and that, in fact, has to be very, very important. And I'm going to go through the whole argument in this talk, But let me start for why I think right away there is a problem with the way we've been doing things so far. So I'm right-handed. If I try to perform the same forehand movement, tennis forehand, with my right hand, I'm going to have a lot less variability than if I try to do it with my left hand. And if we follow the logic that I was following so far, then you'll be forced to conclude that there is somehow noisier neuron in the right motor cortex that controls your left hand than there is in the left motor cortex, because you have more variability with your left hand. But I think you and I would probably agree that the reason I have more variability with my left hand is because I don't have much experience with my left hand. I don't have complete knowledge, or I even don't have partial knowledge, of the dynamic of my left hand. And it is lack of knowledge of how to control my left hand that results in more variability. And that's very much the idea I'm going to be pushing here, is that most of your behavior variability comes from incomplete knowledge. Okay, so here's the point that I want to go through. First, I'm going to argue that suboptimal inference can generate behavior variability. That is, when you have incomplete knowledge of a system, you can't perform optimal inference, you perform suboptimal inference, and we'll see that this causes extra variability. Then I argue that this cause dominates in most situations, that is, for most problems of interest when they're complicated, that's the dominant cause. I'll talk about a few things that this theory explains, and then we'll discuss the implications for neuronal variability. So, to make the point about how suboptimal cause variability, I'm going to go through a very simple example inspired by politics. Imagine you're a politician. So obviously, the most important things to you is what are your approval ratings. So those guys hire companies, and companies provide them with numbers. Say, for instance, that there are two companies, A and B, that every week pulls a lot of people, and then they give you two numbers, A and B. They're your approval rating this week. What should you do with those two numbers to turn them into one number? Well, the basic idea would be, well, take the average, right? Half of A plus half of B. So let's play this game. So here I actually simulated this process. I assume that actually the approval ratings of a week are at 50%, but both companies sample a limited number of people, so there's some variability. And so I simulated the whole process here, and here is the particular series of approval ratings that I got by taking the average of the two numbers that I produced in my simulations. But at that point, you should ask yourself, wait a minute, why did I average? Average is good if the two companies are using the same number of people. But right now, I haven't told you that. So say now you call the companies, and you find out that company A is actually sampling 900 people, and company B is ripping you off, and they're really only sampling 100 people. So at this point, you should change your average strategy, and you should use 0.9A plus 0.1B. So let's go back to this graph. I'm going to reuse the data that were used to generate the green curve and now run them through the optimal average, 0.9a plus 0.1b. So there's still variance in the red curve from week to week. And that's due to the fact that the companies are sampling a limited number of people. What's really interesting is that there's more variability in the green curve than in the red curve, even though both are based on the same data. I did not add any noise to the red curve, right? To the green curve. So where is the extra variability coming from in the green curve? And that comes from a deterministic suboptimal averaging. It's just the fact that I took the wrong average, a suboptimal one, and that caused extra variability. Okay? And that's literally the main point of this talk. Suboptimality can generate extra variability. So that's somewhat of an abstract example. So let's now look at a task that's close to the kind of task that we study a lot in neuroscience, such as orientation discrimination. So now let's imagine that I'm in a task in which I'm seeing either this stimulus or this stimulus. Okay, and on any given trials, I'm showing one of those two images, and I have to answer, did I see clockwise or counterclockwise orientation? I'm going to assume that those images are corrupted by a little bit of sensor noise, either because noise in on your screen or noise in your photoreceptors. And first, we're going to build an optimal filter for this task. So if I know that my images are Gabor patches, I know there are only two of them, and I know the structure of the noise in those images, and I know the frequency of those Gabor patches and the Gaussian envelope of those Gabor patches, I can build an optimal filter for this discrimination task. It turned out now the problem is linear, And that's the filter that you need. So next, I'm going to compare this to another filter that's suboptimal. Not by much. The other filter knows there are only two images. There are Gabor patches. It knows the Gaussian envelope of those patches. It knows the structure of the noise. But it gets a spatial frequency within the Gabor patch off by a factor of 2. Okay, so then here's your filter. So we're going to compare the performance. So first, we're going to take 100 images like this one, always the same Gabor patch, same orientation, but with different realization of the noise. And we're going to monitor the activity of this unit here for those 100 images. So that's the first plot here. And you see there is a little bit of variability because I've got noise in that image here. Okay, now we're going to reuse the same images here, but run them through the green filter. And what you get is this. You get a lot more variability. And the extra variability that you get in the green units is, again, not because I injected noise in the green units. It's just due to the fact that you're using suboptimal filter. And you can see that not only I can get some variability, extra variability, but I can get a lot of extra variability. In this particular case, you can compute it, and 99% of the variability in the green unit is just used due to having a suboptimal filter, which, again, is not suboptimal by a lot. It just got the spatial frequency wrong. And this happens even though I was presenting the same image over and over again, just like we do in psychophysics. So our argument here is that even when the image is constant in the psychophysical experiment, a very large fraction of the variability that you see in the behavior of your subject might be due to suboptimal inference. Okay, so my second point is that this cause will dominate in most situations. What I mean by that, it will dominate whenever you're looking at a hard problem, at a complex computation. So the point I was making so far is suboptimal inference leads to extra variability. And in order to be optimal, what you need to know is how the data was generated. You need to know what we call sometime in Bayesian circle, the generative model, which in the case of the orientation selectivity task was you need to know what is the probability of seeing a particular image given an orientation. In the case of the politicians, you need to know what's the probability of getting a particular approval ratings given how many people are being sampled by the company. So in the case of the political example, actually, this is pretty simple. Knowing this probability boils down to knowing how many people were sampled by each company. In the case of the orientation selectivity example, that's a bit more complicated, but you need to know what kind of images am I looking at, Gabor patches, and you need to know all the features of this patch plus the distribution of the noise. Okay, so that's the key. You need to know this generative model. So let's see how difficult this is in general. Let's just look at motion estimation. Okay, so this is a problem in which we see images and we want to extract motion, which I've denoted as S. So to be optimal, we need to know what is the probability of a given image, a condition on the direction of motion taking a particular value. So let's consider the case in which S is rightward motion. So how many images can have rightward motion? Well, obviously quite a lot. I can have a green circle moving to the right. Now I can have a red star moving to the right. I can have a red car moving to the right. And I could play this game for quite a while. There's an infinite number of images that have motion to the right. And my goal is would be to compute for each of those images the probability of seeing this image given that motion is to the right. So don't even try to think about how you would do that. You can't. That's an intractable task. Okay? We cannot get this probability, so we approximate. And typically what we do is things like we say, oh, okay, so this is intractable. Let's make the world a bit more simple, all right? Let's say the world is made of bars that are moving in different directions, always the same bar, always the same contrast. And for a simple world like this, okay, you can now characterize fully the distribution if you know the distribution of the noise. So you're going to come up with some distribution Q of I given S. It's not the true distribution. It's a massive approximation of the real one that you'd like to have. But for this one, you can design filters. And motion energy filters, for instance, are not far from being the optimal detectors of a bar moving in a particular direction. So if you're using motion energy filters, which are believed to be a pretty good model of what Area NT is doing, you're massively approximating the true distributions of images given the motion. And as a result, you're creating extra variability compared to an ideal observer. So motion estimation is not the hardest problem that your visual system solves. Things like object recognition is even more complex. So as you move towards more and more realistic type of tasks, the kind of stuff that we do every day, again, like object recognitions, there are massive approximations in those inference, and most of the variability is going to come from those approximations. Now, conversely, if you're looking at a very simple task, you should be able to learn the generative model. You should be able to learn how the data was generated in your head. So for instance, consider the problem of detecting just small flashes of light in a complete dark room, and flashes that are so small that they're made of just a few photons, two or three photons. It turns out that's about the limit of what your photoreceptor can reliably detect. Interestingly, behaviorally, that's also the same limit. We can detect reliably about two to three photons on any given flash. Okay, so here's a case where between your photoreceptor and your behavioral response, there's basically no added variability. And the argument is because it's simple enough that you can know the generative model. Okay, so that's kind of the general picture that we're trying to push here. You have stimulus in the world, such as direction of motion, depth of object, identity of objects, that leads to the generation of actual images that gets into your brain. And many people always get really upset because I've got the images in shrink from the front. I am aware that V1 is in the back, so just bear with me. So you have images here that create a sequence of patterns of activity. And at any given point in this network, if you want to perform optimal computation, say here, what you need to know is the statistics of your input, which in this case will be the probability of seeing a particular input pattern of activity, RS, given S. And we can't know that in general. That's intractable for a problem of interest. So the brain somehow implements approximations, which are denoted Q of RS given S. And that's where most of the variability is coming from. And what makes our life difficult is that it's equally plausible to actually model this by injecting noise in the brain. And that's what has made, I think, our life complicated. And why it was tempting to blame the noise in the brain is because it looks equivalent. But one thing to realize is that this approximation here is unavoidable. The problems are intractable. So we guarantee that we're making strong approximations, whereas it's far from clear that neural circuits are really injecting any additional noise on the way during those computations. So what does this theory explain? Well, there's a variety of results that certainly, at least to us, started making sense. One is a very nice experiment that was done by Leslie Osborne, Bill Bialik, and Steve Lisberger a few years ago, in which they measured the variability in smooth pursuit in monkeys. So the monkeys have to track this dot here, and you have here the eye velocity, vertical and horizontal, across many trials. And you see that there's a lot of variability. And what they ask is, okay, where is the variability coming from? Is it due to sensory processing, or is it due to motor control? So through a clever analysis, they came up with this conclusion. They said 93% of the total behavioral variance come from the sensory processing, and only 7% in this particular task come from motor control. So when I read this paper, my first reaction was like, oh yeah, I want to model this kind of stuff. That's really interesting. So here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to assume that there must be a large source of noise somewhere on the sensory side and a tiny noise source somewhere on the motor side. But with the perspective I'm offering now, of course, there is a different way to look at this, which is to say that there is a massive approximation on the sensory side, and the motor control, by contrast, is nearly exact. So how plausible is that? Well, let's look at the motor side here. On the motor side, we're talking about controlling the eyeball. The eyeball is one of the most, it's not one of the, is the most reliable effector in your body. When the motor command is sent to the eyeball does what it's told. So much so that your brain doesn't even bother checking the proprioceptive feedback that comes from the eyes during online motor control. You can cut off the proprioceptive afferences and it has no effect on your ability to move your eyes. It's super reliable. It's been around for a while, 500 million years or so, animals have had eyeball. So there have been plenty of time to learn the controller for the eyeball and to have a pretty much exact controller. So I'm saying here very little approximation. How about on the sensory side? So on the sensory side, you might argue, wait a minute, this is about the simplest stimulus you could imagine. It's a black dot against a white background. So how could you have an approximation for that? Well, Your visual system evolved to process natural images and to process motion in natural images. So motion energy filters is probably a pretty good approximation for natural images, but it turned out that it's not at all the optimal detector for a black dot against a white background. So in fact, when you use motion energy filter, you introduce a massive approximation in your computation, and I would argue that this is what accounts for this result, that 93% of the variance appears to be on the sensory side. Okay, another result that, or another fact that I think can be explained with this approach is why the optic of the eye is terrible. So this is a great quote that I found from von Helmholtz, who was studying at the end of the 19th century the quality of the lens in the human eyeball, and to his surprise he found that it's absolutely appalling. Even by the standards of the 19th century, this was already considered as a crappy piece of hardware. By today's standards, you know, you would certainly never put that in a modern camera. You would get absolute crap out of it. So why is that? So what we're arguing here is the reason is because for the task that you're interested in, like object recognition, depth perception, and so on, you are limited by the quality of the approximations that you have implemented in your brain. And that sets the level of performance that you can achieve. Now, with the optics, what you want to make sure is that it's not the bottleneck. So you want the optic to be just good enough so that the optic alone limits you, let's say, at this level. Beyond that, you can improve the optics all you like. It won't make you any better. So there is no evolutionary advantage to have better optics. And so the idea is that the current state of our optics is just where it should be given the quality of the algorithms that you have in your head. And I think there are quite a few people here who are doing machine learning, but it's fair to say that today, if you look at the machine learning literature on vision processing, nobody will tell you that's the limitation of the camera. The cameras might have been the limitation 20 years ago. The digital cameras were really crappy. Today, they're of excellent quality. You can go from 10 million to 100 million pixels. It's not going to make image recognition any better. And I think the same argument applies here. Martina Navratilova actually illustrates this issue quite nicely. For those of you who are over 40, you remember her. For those of you who are under 40, she was one of the best female tennis players ever, if not the best. She was dominating the field for years and years, and this is her early in her career, and this is her later in her career, about two-thirds in her career, and I don't know if you can notice the difference, but certainly she was wearing glasses. So the day she showed up with those glasses at the press conference, the journalists went crazy. They were like, don't tell us you weren't seeing the ball all those years. And she said, well, yes, it turned out I had really terrible vision. And they gave me some glasses so that now I can actually see the ball. So you might expect that suddenly she went from being amazing to being like beyond amazing. No, she played about the same level. And the reason I would argue is because when you play tennis, yeah, if you're blind, it's no good. But if you see the ball reasonably well, you're now limited by your ability to move your body and hit the ball, not by the quality of the image that you're processing. Again, you can use similar arguments to explain why proprioception is terrible. So proprioception is essential to your ability to move. If you lose proprioception because of a disease, you can't move. You're effectively paralyzed. There's only one guy who's recovered from this, and he's actually coaching other people to deal with this kind of problems. But if you measure now your ability to locate the position of your body in space just based on proprioception, it's terrible compared to, say, your ability to locate the position of your eye, the position of your hand just by looking at it. So why is it essential and yet terrible? So again, this is because the controller that you're using for your hand is not optimal. Your hand is extremely complex. There is no way you can know the dynamic of your hand perfectly well. So you have approximate controller. And so all you need for proprioception is you need to make sure it's not the bottleneck. So it goes up to a certain level, but beyond that, there is no reason to have better proprioception. Okay, so in the last 5-10 minutes of my talk, I want to talk about the implication for neuronal variability. So the argument is suboptimality increases behavioral variability, which in other words says that suboptimality decreases the amount of information that's available in your brain. Okay, so if we want to know how that's reflected in neural responses, how suboptimality affects neural responses, we need to ask the question, what limits information in neural codes? So what limits information in neural codes? There's a lot of literature on this, and one of the answers that kind of dominates the literature right now is that correlation kills you. And more precisely, positive correlations among neurons with similar preferred stimuli is what limits information. And this is based in part on a series of studies that were started by Zohary and Newsom in 94, which showed that if you measure the correlation coefficient, between neurons as a function of the difference in preferred stimulus. So we have neurons with Gaussian tuning curve. We look at the difference in their preferred stimulus. You get this typical pattern. This is data from this Burgers lab, where correlations are strong for neurons that have very similar tuning curves and weak for neurons that have very dissimilar tuning curves. And if you now consider a population of neurons with Gaussian tuning curve that are translation invariant, and you calculate how much information there is when you have this pattern of correlation here, you find that Fisher information, as a function of the number of neurons, follow this pattern. If there are no correlations, neurons are independent, information keeps growing with the number of neurons. As soon as you have positive correlations, so as soon as this peak here is non-zero, you get a saturation of information with the number of neurons. So you're now limited in how much information you have by the positive correlations. So this even led to the idea that perhaps if there was a way to decrease a correlation, say by paying attention, and there's at least one paper along those lines, then perhaps information increases in your population. Because if you look at this graph, when you go from high correlation to smaller correlation, the plateau actually goes up. So it looks like decorrelation is synonym with more information. So that's the question I want to address now. Are correlations among positive neurons really limiting information? And is it true that decorrelation is synonym with more information? And the answer is like, no. This is not a sure recipe. It really depends. So why that? So this is based in part on work that was published by Shamir and Sampolinsky in 2004 that was revisited by Eckert and Bedger recently, in which those guys showed that, indeed, if correlation follows this pattern, and you have a translation invariant tuning curve, then information is limited by correlation. It saturates with the number of neurons. But if you now consider a population of neurons in which the amplitude of the tuning curve varies from one neuron to the next, which is much more realistic, then in fact that result disappears. Now the information grows linearly with the number of neurons, regardless of your level of correlations. Okay. So this tells us that, in fact, those correlations here do not limit information. It also tells us that lowering correlation does not necessarily increase information. Okay, and the reason that if you look at this plot here, the yellow line here is correlation of 0.6, the purple line is correlation of 0.1. So if anything, when I lower the correlation, I actually get less information. So certainly, that's an interesting one. What did I press? Okay. Decreasing correlation with this pattern here is not a sure recipe for increasing information. So back to square one. What limits information in neural codes? What I want to show you now is that it's, in fact, correlations that are proportional to the product of the derivative of the tuning curves. It's a mouthful, so I'm going to actually summarize that into F prime transpose correlations, F prime being the derivative of the tuning curve. So it's correlations that are proportional to this product of the F prime that's really killing you. So why is that? We consider a discrimination task. And here it's important to realize that my statement, my claims, are actually only valid for discrimination task. If you change the task, it might be a different story. But for discrimination, if you have a bunch of neurons with Gaussian tuning curve like this, and you present a particular stimulus S, and you look at the average pattern of activity, it will be a hill of activity like this. If I now go from S to S plus delta S, what's happening is that the hill of activity moves sideways. So if you're doing discrimination, you're looking for motion of the hill sideways. That's your signal. Okay, but neurons are variable. The response varies from trial to trial. So on any given trial, you're never going to see this. You're going to see something like this, or this, or this. And as long as your variability is like this, that is, it doesn't really shift the hill side by side. Okay, even if it's correlated, then you can actually get rid of this variability. You can show that it doesn't really impact your performance. What kills you is a situation like this one. When you present the same S, the hill starts varying from side to side. Now, that kills you because that's in the same direction as your signal. That's what you're looking for, and your noise is mimicking your signal, so that limits your performance. So what kind of correlation do you get from a hill moving sideways? Well, that depends on the neurons you're considering. If the neurons are nearby, when you move the hill in that direction, both neurons go down. If you move the hill in the other direction, both neurons go up. So they're positively correlated, effectively. If you now look at two neurons that are far apart on either side of the hill, if you move in that direction here, one neuron goes down, the other one goes up. If you reverse the direction, you get the opposite pattern. That is, they do the opposite of one another. They're negatively correlated. So if you now plot the correlations as a function of the difference in preferred S, you find this pattern where neurons with similar tuning curves are positively correlated, and otherwise they are negatively correlated. OK, so that's what saturates information. But of course, you might say, wait, the data doesn't show that. Nobody has seen a pattern of correlation like this. And people have looked for it. What they kind of see was Warren and Lisberger reported this kind of pattern, whereas we're saying we should see this. If you overlay their data on top of this pattern, you'll notice in particular that you don't see negative correlations, at least in this pattern. Greg DeAngelis will show you that in his data he sees negative correlation. But more importantly, this correlation also depends on the stimulus, and they don't see that in the data. Basically, most people don't think that there is any such correlations in actual in vivo data. But what if the correlation that we see in vivo is a combination of this correlation and this correlation, the sum of the two? And what if this component here, f prime transpose, is actually tiny? It turned out it will still limit your correlation. So maybe this is introduced by some kind of network dynamics. Turned out it has no impact on information, but it creates correlation. And this is really the one that's introduced by your computations. So would that work? So here we just actually run a simulation in which we have a Gaussian tuning curve with different amplitude. And first, we simulate patterns of activity from those guys with a standard pattern of correlation that decays with delta S. And then we computed information as a function of neurons. And we found, just like Shamir and Sampolinsky, Eckert and colleagues, that information keeps growing despite the presence of those correlations. Next, we generated patterns of activity in which now the correlations are the same as before, plus a tiny f prime component. So tiny that you just simply can't tell just by looking at the correlation curve that it's there. And now we compute information from those neurons, and we find that information saturates. So a very tiny effect, very tiny difference in correlation that effectively you can't see by direct measurement of the correlation results in a massive change in information that's in the system. So what I'm saying here is that suboptimality decreases information in your brain, and that information in neural circuits is controlled by f prime transpose correlations. And therefore, suboptimality must generate f prime transpose correlation. If you become less optimal, for instance, if you become more optimal, for instance, by paying attention or through perceptual learning, our prediction is that what really changes is the f prime transpose correlation. That's what accounts for your behavioral improvement. However, this effect might be very small, and it seems unlikely that you will see it just by measuring the correlations themselves. You're going to have to do other type of analysis, such as decoding. And just as a word of caution, decorrelation in general might or may not work. It really depends on what kind of codes you're looking at. Certainly, with the kind of population code I showed you, just plain decorrelation is not going to improve information. You need to change the f prime transpose component. So, conclusion. The brain is noisy. And don't get me wrong. There's plenty of sources of noise in the brain. Synapses are noisy. The circuits might be chaotic. And I can't go on for a while. But what I'm arguing is that this internal noise is not the primary cause of behavioral variability. Instead, we think that it's actually suboptimal that's causing most of the variability. And suboptimality is really controlling the correlation that are proportional to f prime transpose. And to finish, I just want to end with one comment. I was recently at a conference where one of my colleagues, who's also working on the source of behavior variability, was presenting his work. And he's one of the people I've been teasing over the last few years about his use of the word noise. He kept on saying noise, and noise in the brain is responsible for behavior variability. And I kept on telling him, well, don't go so fast, perhaps it's something else. And I noticed this year that for the first time ever, I won the argument. He no longer uses the word noise in his presentation. Instead, he uses noise. So it looks like our theories finally have an impact in the field, and it's right here. It's tiny, but it's in the right direction. Thank you very much.
So the theory you described in the beginning seemed like a theory that could be quantitative, but then the examples you gave were very qualitative. You said, I can predict the Lisberger result, but it didn't show us a fit through those data, or prediction of a new phenomenon. Is there a way to make this more quantitative?
Yeah, and that's where you come in, right? I'm a theoretician, you're the experimentalist, you're the one who goes through the experimental fits. It's going to be task by task. We need to design a task, we need to think about the stimulus, we need to do the ideal observer analysis. I mean, we certainly didn't go through the whole procedure here with the Lisberger things, but there is nothing that should prevent us from doing this, except that I don't do experiments. Jonathan? Oh, I'm sorry.
So I really enjoyed this talk. I was wondering about one thing. So you're arguing that for some tasks or for some parts of the processing, it doesn't make sense or it's not possible to do accurate generative modeling. But your conclusion seems to be, in this case, we just do inaccurate generative modeling. So could there be a more radical conclusion that maybe in some parts we don't do generative modeling at all?
That we don't do a generative model at all?
Can you repeat the question? I think it was slightly too late.
I think Berner was arguing that for most tasks of interest, it's impossible to model the generative model. So we make approximations. So does it even make sense to talk about the generative model? I think that's what you were saying.
I mean, you were saying that it's... So if I'm...
You have to speak up a bit because it was hard to hear you.
If I understood you correctly, you were arguing that for some parts of the processing, we cannot do accurate generative modeling.
Yes.
So you seem to conclude from that, let's just do inaccurate generative modeling.
Yes.
But another conclusion might be that for those parts where we cannot do accurate generative modeling, we just do something else. We do discriminative modeling, for instance.
Yeah, I think this is almost semantic at this point, and I'd rather not get into this discussion, because the question is, when you start using heuristics, do you want to call them approximate generative model or heuristics? I don't personally mind. For this talk, it doesn't change anything, right? I leave that debate to Giger Renzer and those guys. I think it's helpful from a machine learning point of view to think and to know what you're really doing is you're taking a true generative model and you're doing some kind of approximation, and you can even identify exactly the type of approximation that you're making. But I'm well aware that in machine learning, that's a big debate.
So this was, of course, very provocative. There are two different things that I'm worried about. One is if you take a typical sensory decision task, and you're fairly close to threshold, but you do it in a kind of in a double pass way, you would predict the subject would be reliably wrong, not just randomly wrong. And I don't think that that's generically the case. The other thing is that even if your approximate filter is really wrong, it might not be wrong enough to account for errors. In other words, you know, you could be off by a factor of 10 to the 10th in the probabilities, but the probabilities differ by a factor of 10 to the 20th between the alternatives. So you still get it right all the time with a really bad filter. And I think that may be what's happening in motion.
I think that's just back to Matteo's question. And here now we're going to have to play the numbers. So your first point is about double pass procedure. I show you the exact same sequence of stimulus one day and the next day, and people throw some variability. So yes, they're going to be, especially in simple behavioral tasks, simple tasks where the generative model might be known almost perfectly, then you're going to start being dominated by internal noise. So as I said, there is some internal noise, but I'm saying for complex tasks, I doubt that this is what's that the internal noise is what's dominating. But in fact, as Matteo pointed out, I didn't tell you what is a complex task, what's a simple task, and where is the limit. So I basically agree with what you're saying. And the second point is actually, I think, a really important one, which is, indeed, I can massively approximate my generative model and sometimes pay almost no price for doing so, that I don't get an extra variability. And there's this whole debate about in the retina, maybe the code is exactly like that, that it's a kind of code where you don't need to know the full generative model. So again, I think it's going to be a task-dependent thing. For object recognition, I'd be absolutely shocked if the internal noise is what limits you, given what I know of Kirsten's studies and these kind of things. But I'd be happy to discuss that more with you.
Okay, two more questions. One up there.
Okay, so up here. Hi, Alex. So there are...
Can you wave? Because I don't know who you
are. Hello.
Oh, that's Matteo. Okay, I couldn't recognize your voice.
So there's particular manipulations of the stimulus that are well known to change the amount of variability that you see in, say, visual cortex, right? You can change the contrast, you can do other things. So does that mean that I mean, following your logic, our cortex does different kinds of approximations for different levels of contrast, or it's particularly well adapted to high contrast, but not for low contrast?
No, it's contrast, I would say it's a property of the image itself.
But why is there more variability for different levels of contrast? Or is there more neural variability? If the neural variability is dominated by approximations, why do those approximations hurt you to different degrees at different contrast levels?
Now, I think maybe I'm misunderstanding your question. I would say with contrast, this is actually a case where physically what the signal you get gets worse and worse as you go toward lower contrast, and so that's where your uncertainty goes up, right? So I don't think it has to do with the noise in the brain changing with contrast or the approximation changing with contrast.
You found a wonderful, disturbing correlation which reduces the information a lot, the FF prime, the slope correlation. A couple of things. Is there a natural way why that particular type of correlation would arise very easily? And is there some sort of expansion in types of correlation that might arise, sort of like a Wiener expansion or Taylor series or something? And what other things have you tried that didn't work in reducing the information?
It's not so much what works and doesn't work. It's just if you work it out. So we have all, I mean, I'd be happy to send you the math behind this. If you ask yourself, if I have a population code with Gaussian tuning curve and a correlation matrix, and you say, what component of that correlation matrix is going to limit your information, you can prove that the only direction that matters is the F prime direction.
I see.
No other direction matters. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways to show that fairly easily. It's very intuitive. I try to show you one reason, and it's this shift of the hill sideways is the only signal you're looking for. So the question is, so it emerges every time you build a multi-layer network that performs the kind of tasks that we're looking at here, like discrimination. Mm-hmm. In there, if the information is limited, you will have F prime transpose correlation. Mm-hmm. So otherwise, information is not limited. So right. It emerges naturally in as soon as you perform computation.
So you have to look for other things and other tasks.
So that's why I was careful to say discrimination, because that's the case in which the signal is F prime. If the signal is something else, then other kind of correlation will limit you.
All right, okay. Let's thank Alex again for this stimulating talk. Okay, and we will proceed with Greg DeAngelis, and I will just introduce him shortly. Greg is with